Many Americans were celebrating on Super Bowl Sunday in 2017. But in Florida's Palm Beach County, the sounds of gunfire from an assault-style weapon and a rifle interrupted a laid-back get-together over a bonfire at 1105 Mohawk Street. Neighbors mistook the noise for fireworks. By the end of the February 5, 2017 attack, three people were killed. 26-year-old Sean Henry, 20-year-old Kelly Doherty, and 24-year-old Brandy El-Salhi. The party was almost frozen in time when police arrived at the crime scene. Kelly still clutched a cigarette in her fingers. Kelly's father was so devastated by her death, he couldn't come to the courtroom. "I lost a piece of myself, a piece of my soul," he wrote to the court, calling it a nightmare that was made worse because he lived it in the public eye. Kelly had a contagious smile and was just getting started with so much life ahead of her, he said in the letter. Just before her death, Brandy was excited about hitting adult milestones, like landing a raise at work and being on the verge of turning a quarter century old, as she phrased it to her mother. On the day of her 25th birthday, her family buried her. Sean's father remembered his son as someone who could tumble on the ground with little children and then turn around and talk politely with seniors. Sean celebrated his 26th birthday on a mission trip in Haiti, building houses for an orphanage. On the day of his death, Sean started the morning by going to church and reading Bible verses with Sunday school kids. Nearly 1,000 people attended his funeral service. Sean had been shot 17 times. Two of the bullets were shot at close range, leaving the prosecution to assume he was the intended target. "The two women just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time," authorities said. Sean wasn't perfect by any means and made some bad decisions in his life, but he didn't deserve to be murdered like that, his father told the court. Prosecutors accused two men, 26-year-old Chris Visada and 26-year-old Marcus Stewart, of being the killers. But that called into question a key witness's account, who identified three shooters that night. In the eyes of the defense, somebody else, a third person, Luke Katsoukos, was the person with the clearest motivation to commit the shooting. And Luke, with unmistakable gold teeth, was also identified at the scene. But Luke was never arrested. Only Chris and Marcus were, bringing a very important question to the jury. Did prosecutors have the right killers? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 129. It's not easy to prioritize yourself when there's a lot on your plate, but investing in your mental health has long-term benefits, and with Talkspace, it can actually be affordable. Unlike in-person therapy sessions, Talkspace gives you 24/7 access to your online therapy room. Send unlimited messages to your dedicated therapist, and they'll respond daily, 5 days a week. Best of all, an entire month on Talkspace costs about the same amount as a single in-person session. And the Talkspace network is huge. It's composed of thousands of licensed therapists who have experience in over 40 specialties, including but not limited to treating depression, anxiety, substance abuse, trauma, relationship issues, food and eating, and much more. Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest encryption technology to store client information. The bottom line is that we all need someone to talk to. Talkspace wants to give us the support we deserve at a price we can afford. As a listener of Court Junkie, you get $100 off your first month on Talkspace. To match with your perfect therapist, go to Talkspace.com or download the app. Make sure to use the code COURT to get $100 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's COURT at Talkspace.com. Nowadays, I think many of us would rather color our hair in the comfort of our own home. But if you're like me, you're likely wondering how you would find the right color, and then how much does it cost? Well, Madison Reed makes coloring your hair at home affordable and they give you the tools you need to choose your perfect color. So back in the day, there used to only be two options for coloring your hair. You could either try outdated at-home color or spend time and money at a salon. But now, Madison Reed takes coloring your hair at home to the next level and gives you beautiful, professional hair color delivered right to your door, starting at just $22. What makes Madison Reed's color unique is that it's crafted by master colorists who blend nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm tones to create over 55 gorgeous multidimensional shades. And don't worry, finding the perfect shade is easy. You just go to their website, madison-reed.com, and take their quiz that will ask you things like what you want your end result to be, what your hair texture is, things like that. And then they match you with your perfect shade. So do your hair coloring at home and look as if you just came from the salon. And now, Court Junkies can get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit by using the code COURT. Go to madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. That's madison-reed.com and use the code COURT.
February 5th, 2017. While most were preparing or watching the Super Bowl, some having a party, some just enjoying friends, Christopher Posada and Marcus Stewart were planning the murder of Charlie Voorpeibel and Sean Henry.
In June 2019, at Chris Posada's murder trial, the prosecutor laid out their case against him. She said that as Brandy, Kelly, and Sean were gathered in the backyard of a man named Charles Voorpeibel's house on that Super Bowl Sunday, masked gunmen came over, guns blazing. Charles was lucky enough to escape, but the others were not. She said Chris Posada and Marcus Stewart were the gunmen. Surveillance video from the neighborhood shows a black car belonging to Chris Posada circling the block, then parallel parking. Two individuals get out of the vehicle near a path that leads to Charles's house. Then, after the shooting, but before cops had been alerted to it, one officer notices a car driving erratically. He pulls it over and a man falls out. He is injured and bleeding. It's Chris Posada who tells them that he was at a friend's house, Charles Voorpeibel's house, and that he got shot.
Christopher Posada was at the house, but he was not at the house as a guest of Charlie Voorpeibel.
She said the driver was Marcus Stewart. In their opening statements, the defense said what happened on Super Bowl Sunday was the result of a conflict between Charles Voorpeibel, the renter of the home, and another man named Luke Katsoukas. She said Luke has a very intimidating look, covered in tattoos, wears dreadlocks and gold veneers or grills on his teeth. She said Chris was a sort of middleman in the conflict, and that on the night of the murders, Chris took Luke and Marcus to Charles's house so they could talk and work it out. She said no one knew that Brandy and Kelly would be there. They knocked at the door, but no one answered, so they went to the backyard where they heard laughing. It was dark. The bonfire had largely burned out. She said suddenly, Luke started firing. Chris started running towards the carport where they came in, but he too was shot. Grievously injured, she said. Marcus and Luke picked him up and carried him down the driveway. They put him in Sean's car and they fled the scene. Afterwards, someone pushed Chris out of the car and into the path of a police vehicle. Mr. Posada did not go to that residence with the intent of committing any violent act at all, she said. He went there to try and stop a further conflict. She said there are no evil people in this case, but there are people who are misguided and who are trying to solve conflicts in their own way. She said Chris is not guilty of murder. The Super Bowl Sunday party host, who was the lone survivor of the shooting, strode through the courtroom and took his seat at the witness stand to testify. Unlike other witnesses at the trial, Charles Voorpeibel didn't wear a suit. The 29-year-old was dressed in blue inmate scrubs, his wrists handcuffed, his legs shackled. The prosecution didn't waste any time telling the jury why.
You've introduced yourself to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury, and you're in custody, is that correct?
Yes.
Are you in state custody or federal custody?
I'm in federal custody.
Now tell us what sentence you're serving and for what?
I'm serving an 8-year sentence in federal prison for trafficking with a firearm and felony possession of a firearm.
Are those charges, did they arise from what was found in your home the night of this homicides?
Yes, they did.
Charles Vorpagel was a witness with a past, smoking pot in high school, dropping out to get his GED. He financed his living in his 20s by drug dealing and selling guns. Charles smoked pot every day, although he took harder drugs like cocaine and ecstasy. Charles was also a drinker, he testified. He admitted he had anger problems and never got treatment for his drug addictions. Charles lived in Jupiter, a quiet town on the southeastern coast of Florida, known for a famous historic lighthouse and as the spring training home for the Miami Marlins and the St. Louis Cardinals. Where Charles called home was a rented house at 1105 Mohawk Street. It was a 10-minute drive from the Atlantic Ocean and 30 minutes north of West Palm Beach. The Mohawk Street house was a nondescript, white, one-story house with a large palm tree out front and a lagoon-shaped pool out back. Inside, Charles kept a stockpile of weapons and drugs. Charles was testifying against his friend, Chris Visada, whom he had known for 5 or 6 years. Chris connected into Charles's social circle through the two men's illegal dealings. Sean, one of the shooting victims, was reportedly also caught up in drug dealing, just like Chris and Charles. Charles considered Sean to be one of his closest friends, growing up together when the two bonded over more wholesome activities like Boy Scouts and church events. Now, Sean was staying at Charles's house. In the small town of Jupiter, Florida, there was drama brewing between the drug dealers and money. Charles and Sean were caught up in it.
In your mind, what was the relationship between Chris Visada and Luke Kasukos?
They were friends.
Did you know they were good friends?
I believe them to be good friends, yes.
Did there come a time when you and Sean and or Sean began to have some issues with Luke?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Sean and I believe that Luke had robbed another friend of ours' house.
All right. And when about was that in terms of, and let's use the homicides as a benchmark time? How soon prior to the homicides did you guys begin to kind of put that together?
About 2 weeks.
You told us that you and Sean both believed that Luke had robbed a friend of yours, correct?
Yes.
What feelings did that bring up in you, yourself?
Anger.
What about Sean?
He was angry too.
Charles and Sean wanted to shake out Luke Katsukos' address and find him and confront him. They began asking around. Charles inquired about Luke's place several times to Chris, who wasn't forthcoming.
Did Chris ever give you Luke's address?
No.
Did he ask why are you looking for him?
Yes.
And what'd you tell him?
I told him that he owed a lot of friends money, and that we believe he robbed another friend's house.
Did he say anything, like he'll pass the message along or leave Luke alone, anything?
No.
But did he ever give you any information about Luke, where he could be found?
He never gave me an exact address, just guesses where he might live.
Did any of those guesses materialize?
No.
Did you know how close Luke and Chris Visada really were?
No.
Did you think Visada was a friend of yours?
Yes.
The night before the shootings, Chris came over to Charles's house, asking about buying guns. Charles led Chris into a room where he kept his arsenal of weapons and ammunition. He showed him two different assault rifles, although Chris didn't end up buying anything. A few minutes later, Sean confronted Chris alone in the back room of Charles's house. They had a private conversation for 10 minutes. Charles testified he assumed he knew what the two men were discussing. The prosecutor didn't press him on details. After that, Chris left. Prosecutors believe Chris's Saturday visit to buy guns was a ruse, hiding the real reason he was there, to either scope out the house or learn what he might be up against. The next day, it was the biggest football game of the year, although Charles wasn't preoccupied with the game. He didn't even know what time it began.
Tell me about that. It's Super Bowl Sunday, right?
Yes.
Had you had any plans to watch the game?
No.
Why not?
I don't care much for sports. I don't watch football. Okay. I didn't have cable at my house.
But plans had been in motion that day for Charles and Sean to hang out with Brandy and Kelly. Charles had met Brandy when she started dating one of his friends in high school. She went to the University of Florida and hung out with Charles when she came home on breaks. Kelly was the only person that Charles didn't know well out of the group. Kelly tagged along with her friend, Brandy. Around 10:15 p.m., Kelly and Brandy arrived with beer and cigarettes. Their non-traditional Super Bowl party began. Sean, Charles, and the two women stuck the beer in the fridge, snorted a few lines of Coke, lit a joint, and then went outside in the backyard to sit around the fire, Charles testified. Charles also took ecstasy. Sean had a revolver on him that he kept hidden, but he would never get a chance to use it. Charles wasn't carrying a weapon outside, although he had plenty of guns inside. This gathering on Super Bowl Sunday, although nobody was watching the game, was an intimate night. No loud music, no big RSVP list. Just the four 20-somethings laughing and telling jokes.
What was the mood?
We were all relaxing, having fun, ready to enjoy the evening.
Charles had been drinking and had cocaine and ecstasy in his body, but he felt he was in control. His senses were in order. He knew what was reality. He testified he used drugs regularly and had built up a high tolerance. The group sat outside for only a few minutes, less than the time it took to finish a cigarette, when the night tragically changed. In the far corner of his backyard, Charles heard what he thought were a chain of firecrackers going off. He saw at least 7 or 8 flashes, the muzzle flash emitting from the barrel of a gun in the nighttime. It appeared to be coming from 2 guns. Charles told the court he thought he saw 3 figures, all wearing dark clothes, but that he wasn't entirely sure. Their faces were covered, although he could make out one man's gold teeth gleaming from the gun flashes and dreadlocks sticking out from the bottom of his mask. Charles fell out of his chair and ran.
When the shooting started, I fell backwards out of my chair. I saw 3 figures rapidly approaching from this direction, firing guns at the same time. And I fell backwards out of my chair from right here and turned and ran through this alley on the side of my house.
Okay.
First, jumping over this AC unit, I landed in a pile of brush that was stored on the side of my yard. I took several more steps and leaped over the fence. You can't see it, but it's right here. It divides my front and backyard. I landed on the other side, and I continued hearing shots, and I jumped through. There's a wall of bushes right here separating my neighbor's front porch from my yard. I jumped through the bushes. I landed on my neighbor's porch. And I got up and yanked his door open and told him to call 911 that someone is shooting people in my yard.
The neighbor pushed Charles out and told him to go hide. The neighbor then locked the door. Charles hid behind trash cans, afraid he was being chased. Seconds later, he sought refuge behind his neighbor's truck. That way, he could keep an eye on his own house from his vantage point. He heard arguing and saw the figures approaching his driveway. He noticed one of the figures helped another get into the car, as if the person was injured and struggling to walk. They then climbed into a car parked on the driveway. It was Sean's Honda, and drove away. During the trial, the jury listened to Charles testify against Chris, both drug dealers with substance abuse issues. It would boil down to credibility. Who would they believe? Here's how Law and Crime's Jesse Weber and trial attorney Brad Micklin analyzed the case.
It's a complicated case with a lot of different players, but the interesting part about it is they don't all seem to be innocent people. So Mr. Verpagel, whose house this was, he's already pled guilty to federal drug and weapons charges. He's going to be a key witness for the prosecution, saying that he was the intended target. Sean Henry, is one of the victims, is accused of being involved in illegal activity. What's your thoughts on this case?
It's a complicated case. You have a lot of people, you have a lot of moving parts, and all of the potential witnesses, like you were just naming, are going to have credibility problems and probably recollection problems if there's drugs involved. So I think it's going to be a long way before we even have insight into where this goes.
Now, the defendant says that he's the victim. He came over that night just to talk to Verpagel because Verpagel was having some sort of conflict with a business associate. Again, they were involved in illegal activity. Now, the idea of where he shot, because the defendant, it was shot. What does that tell you?
It looks like he was fleeing. It doesn't necessarily mean he didn't do the shooting or wasn't involved in it, but he was certainly trying to get away.
Yeah, he was shot in the lower back and the buttocks region, so you kind of get an idea of what's happening here.
With the shooters gone, Charles said he ran back to his house and into the yard to see if anyone had survived. Soon, he would go into shock.
I saw Kelly sitting in her chair still, lifeless. I didn't immediately see Sean or Brandy, so I screamed for both of their names. They didn't answer. I screamed one more time and then continued running and went back into my house.
Charles went inside and grabbed a loaded shotgun in case another shooter appeared. But he changed his mind. He put the gun back and then hurried to the neighbor's house, who assured him 911 had already been called. Soon, a police car arrived in the neighborhood. Charles flagged the police car down, waving his arms. The prosecutor asked him about his emotional state.
I'm having a panic attack. My breathing was erratic. My heart was pumping very fast. I was having trouble speaking. I was still trying to understand what had just happened.
Charles wasn't allowed back inside his house after that. He sat down on the ground and started crying, the events of the bonfire replaying in his head. Charles was already a convicted felon with firearms in his house. Plus, he was in possession of multiple drugs, including cocaine. All that seemed secondary, though.
But that night, you knew you weren't supposed to have the firearms. Obviously, you weren't supposed to have the drugs, right?
Yes.
But did you yourself go to the police and tell them what happened in that house and tell them to go in there?
Yes.
And why is that?
I was worried about my friend's well-being. I didn't know if they were dying or dead yet. I thought that some of them could be saved.
As you were out there sitting on the ground, waiting for the rest of the police officers to come, did you begin to think about the trouble you were going to get into?
Yes, after talking to the officer and him not letting me go anywhere and him not going back there to help, I sat and replayed what had happened in my head and I realized that I was going to go to prison.
Charles's instincts were right. He was going to prison, eventually. With much at stake, Charles still cooperated with police and allowed them to search his house. He was taken to the hospital for his injuries he sustained from his escape, jumping and running from the crime scene. Charles went into shock and had a seizure stemming from his panic attack. At the hospital, he gave a statement to a detective, even though he acknowledged he was given medicine that affected his speech. We'll get into more trial testimony right after this quick break from today's sponsors. We all deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why. That's why Ritual's founder is on a mission to reinvent the vitamin industry. Kat Schneider and her team of scientists at Ritual are making clinically tested a new normal. Not only have they obsessively researched each nutrient in their visionary women's multivitamin, carefully choosing forms that are absorbable by the body, but they've also tested their formula. Science-backed isn't just a buzzword for them, it's the standard. There are so many reasons why I love Ritual. For one thing, they are super transparent about the high-quality ingredients they put in their vitamins. They use vegan-certified, non-GMO, gluten-free, and allergen-free ingredients. And everything is listed right there on their website, so you can check that out at any time. Secondly, and I've said this before, their no-nausea capsule design is gentle on an empty stomach, which is awesome. And there's also a little mint tab in every bottle, so you don't have to deal with any gross aftertaste like you do with many omega-3s. Daily changes can lead to big results, so start small today. Ritual is offering Court Junkies 10% off your first 3 months. Try it out, satisfaction guaranteed. Go to ritual.com/court to start your ritual today. That's 10% off during your first 3 months at ritual.com/court. Since we all love podcasts, I have a recommendation for you, one that you should really be listening to. It's The Jordan Harbinger Show. And I know that every day somebody tells you that you just have to listen to some podcast, and you nod and say sure, and then you never listen to it. Well, don't let that happen here. Jordan's show, which Apple named one of its best of 2018, is aimed at making you a better informed, more critical thinker, so you can get a sense of how the world actually works and come to your own conclusions about what's happening, even inside your own brain. Each episode is a conversation with a different, fascinating guest. And when I say there's something for everyone here, I really mean that. In one episode, Jordan talks to a hostage negotiator from the FBI, who offers techniques on how to get people to like and trust you, which sounds useful and disturbing at the same time. Another episode tells the story of a cinematographer who discovered a lost city in the jungle and made one of the most important archaeological finds of the century. Two other episodes I enjoyed were with Danny Trejo, inmate number one, and Amanda Knox. Jordan's always focused on pulling useful, practical insights out of his brilliant guests. And we're not talking about pop psychology or wishy-washy self-help stuff here. The episodes are loaded with bits of wisdom that you can use to legitimately change your mind and improve your life right away. If that's not worth checking out, I'm not sure what is. I really enjoy this show, and I think you will as well. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And stay tuned to the end of this episode for a clip of Jordan's episode with Cesar Millan. 6 minutes after the 911 call was made, Palm Beach County Sheriff deputies pursued a sedan, Sean's stolen car, for traffic violations. According to the probable cause affidavit from the Jupiter Police Department, the deputies believed a drunk driver was erratically behind the wheel, the prosecution said. They followed the car, unaware how lucky they were. They hadn't yet connected the Honda to the events that unfolded at Mohawk Street. According to the affidavit, about 1 mile from the murder scene, a man got out of the Honda from the rear driver's side and collapsed onto the road. It was Chris, injured from gunshot wounds to his back area. He was right back at the spot where he had parked his black car. Chris told police he had been shot by someone unknown at his buddy's house. In Chris's pockets were a loaded magazine for a .40-caliber Glock handgun, a stray .40-caliber bullet, and a black glove. Authorities had also found a .40-caliber handgun left behind in Charles's backyard. During the trial, DNA from that gun at the crime scene was connected back to Chris.
Because the evidence pretty much tells you that Asada had that .40. It's dropped at the scene. Maybe he got shot. Dropped it. We know he got shot. It had a pretty serious wound. And Posada has that .40 magazine in his pocket when he's found on Visayas Road.
At least two firearms were used to commit the killings based on the spent bullet casings scattered in the backyard, although it was impossible for the medical examiner to say which firearms killed each person. During the trial, Assistant State Attorney Jill Richstone strapped on plastic gloves and picked up the assault weapon strapped onto cardboard as a display. She awkwardly held up the weapon for the jury to see its bulky size, as she described the destruction it could cause to the human body, especially with hollow point bullets. The bullets made the gun even more lethal.
This has one purpose and one purpose only, to kill brutally. And guess whose DNA is on it? Remember, she said she swabbed here and here, where you're gonna hold it. Chris Posada. What are you doing with an assault rifle?
The next day, authorities found what they believed were additional murder weapons, two firearms discarded in a culvert near Interstate 95.
He can't walk down I-95 with an assault rifle. So they had to hide it. So they hid it right down near where the car was found, in a culvert on I-95. When the dogs came, the canine dog came and found it. So we have the, in that culvert, we've got the assault rifle that has Chris Posada's DNA on it. We found two gloves. One has Posada, I'll go through the DNA in a moment, but Posada's all over one of those gloves. Marcus Stewart's on the other.
Chris Posada was all over this case, the prosecution said. About 15 feet away from the weapons was Sean's stolen Honda that had run out of gas. Left behind in the Honda was a pillow with Chris's blood on it. Wounded, but not mortally, Chris was taken to the hospital for emergency surgery for his gunshot injuries. According to the probable cause affidavit, while there, Chris made several unsolicited statements to police who were providing security. Chris said he had a spiritual moment after the shooting. "Here I am looking at heaven. I just killed three people and I'm looking at heaven," he said. Later on, Chris denied making the comments, as the affidavit noted. Chris was charged with three counts of first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, and a felon in possession of a firearm or ammunition. 2 days after the shooting, Charles went to the police station. Officers read him his Miranda rights, but he spoke willingly. He spoke with the detective for 4 or 5 hours without an attorney present during his first interview. He still wasn't allowed to go back to his Mohawk Street rental. It was now a crime scene. The police paid for him to stay in a hotel. That's where he was when the FBI arrested him on federal gun and drug charges, 4 days after the shootings. A federal judge eventually sentenced him to 8 years in prison.
In testifying and in cooperating throughout this, and in testifying in this case and potentially another case against Mr. Stewart, are you hoping that your cooperation will convince the federal judge to give you a lighter sentence?
Yes.
Is there a guarantee that that's going to happen?
No.
Even if it weren't going to happen, would you be cooperating with us?
Yes.
On cross-examination, Assistant Public Defender Elizabeth Ramsey asked Charles to describe what Luke Katsoukos looked like.
He's half black and half Hispanic. He's taller than me. He's very built. He works out a lot. He also has dreads and he has gold teeth.
He was asked about his role in the drug dealer's feud. Charles said he was plotting how to take down his rival, Luke, after his friend had some of his drugs stolen. Charles blamed Luke for the robbery.
So, Joey Keating had been robbed right before you came back of 6 pounds of marijuana, which I believe you told me once was worth about $14,000.
Yes.
Okay. And that's what sparked the real urgency, you say, to do something about Luke Kasukas.
Yes.
Okay. That just happened to occur at a time, sir, where you also were lacking in funds from your drug dealing.
Yes.
Okay. And wanted to expand your business by partnering up with another individual.
Yes.
Okay. So although you told the police that this didn't have anything to do with competition.
It did not.
Okay. So, sir, Luke Kasukas is not allowed to come to your house, correct?
No.
All right. In fact, you have told people that you would never allow Luke Kasukas to walk across the threshold into your house.
That's correct.
Okay. You have known that he was good friends with Mr. Fasada.
Yes.
There had been times that Mr. Fasada had actually come there and Luke would be in the car and you wouldn't allow Luke to come into the house.
That's correct.
Okay. So this had been a relatively long-standing conflict with Mr. Kasukas.
Yes.
Ramsey pointed out that Sean and Charles plotted to do something to Luke to shut him down.
And so when you came back with your expanding business, you and Sean began talking about getting rid of Mr. Kasukas.
Yes.
Okay. And when we talk about getting rid of Mr. Kasukas, you're talking about murdering him.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. It wasn't about sending him a message. It wasn't about going out and, you know, threatening his friends. It wasn't about just trying to woo away his business. It was about killing him.
No, it was more about finding him.
Well, and killing him.
Not necessarily. What we really wanted was to confront him about the money he owed and the people he had robbed.
It wasn't a secret in Jupiter that Charles wanted to find Luke.
You're letting everybody know that you are actively looking for where Luke lives, when he's going to make deals, when he's going to have money, when he's going to be at the gym, right?
Yes.
Okay. It wouldn't surprise you to know that a lot of people knew about that in Jupiter, would it?
No.
Okay. And then despite the fact that you knew that Mr. Fasada was a friend of Luke Kasukas, you and Sean decided to contact him and essentially ask for his blessing to murder Luke Kasukas.
I believe that Chris was pretending to be Luke's friend at the time.
Ramsey had argued that Chris was acting as a peacemaker between Charles and Luke. But not that Charles was aware. He testified that he didn't remember Chris ever attempting to broker a treaty between himself and Luke. But he said he was too focused on finding out where Luke lived. Charles' testimony wavered as to whether he saw two or three figures that night.
At some point, you hear what sounds like a string of firecrackers.
That's correct.
Right? And then you see muzzle flash.
Yes.
Okay. Today, you told the state that you were uncertain of how many people were there, right?
How many people I had at my house or
no,
how many shooters were there. Yes.
Okay. But originally, you had told the police that you were certain that it was three.
Yes.
Okay. And in fact, as late as May 20th of this year, just a few weeks ago, you sat down with me to give a sworn discovery deposition.
Yes.
Right? And you actually told me that when the individuals left the house, as you've described in your direct, and go into the driveway, that you saw two people carrying one person.
What I saw was two or three figures. And one of them appeared to be helping the other.
You also told the police that in the backyard, you could actually see three individuals. And one of them was closer to the pool, One was a little bit more to the right when you're looking at them, and still another further right.
Yes.
Okay. And that they were moving and approaching when you saw the muzzle flashes.
Yes.
Okay. And you described in your initial statement, sir, that two of the individuals you believed were black and one was white.
Yes.
Okay. And one individual you described as being bulkier in size, having gold teeth, having dreadlocks, and being tattooed, and being of a heavier build than the others.
Yes, I don't know about being tattooed, but one of them was much larger than the others.
The person Charles could most vividly identify was Luke. And Luke clearly had reason to be concerned for his own life, since he likely knew Charles was hunting him. For the defense, it was the motive of the crime, and it revealed who the shooter really was. The prosecution's closing arguments began on the trial's seventh day. They presented a striking image of Chris and Marcus creeping through back alleys in the darkness, armed to the teeth, they said, as they ambushed four helpless sitting ducks in the backyard. Kelly and Brandy, the only people without ties to the drug trade, were in the wrong place at the wrong time, they said. The shooters, whether there were two or three of them, had heartlessly killed two innocent women who were caught up in their drug feud. Kelly had been shot four times, Brandy five times.
He did not care. Posada didn't care. Marcus Stewart didn't care. And if there was a third guy back there, and if it was Luke Kosciuszko's, he didn't care.
The state identified Chris and Marcus as the shooters, but if there was a third shooter, that third person with the gold teeth and dreads, then, you know what? It didn't matter if there was a third person back there, the prosecutor said. They're all three responsible, and they are all three principals to each other. If there was a third shooter, the prosecution argued, his judgment day would eventually come. But right now, today, it was Chris Visada's turn. Charles was the luckiest person in the world because he escaped. He lived. Now he could testify. Otherwise, the prosecution noted, the case would be in some serious trouble. When it was the defense's turn, Assistant Public Defender Elizabeth Ramsey pointed out that Luke, the one with the greatest motivation to commit the shooting, had not been charged with any crime.
The government stood up here and kept saying, well, Marcus Stewart, Christopher Visada, and maybe there was a third person. Maybe there was a third. You know there was a third person. You know Luke Kosciuszko was there. You know it. Hirsch told you, we credited the statements of Marcus Stewart to such an extent that we put it in a sworn affidavit and got a warrant based on that, because he told us Luke Kosciuszko was there. Luke Kosciuszko was a shooter. He was there. He is the individual that had the greatest motivation for committing this crime. He did not have a friendship with Sean Henry. He did not have a friendship with Mr. Vorpagel. They didn't like each other. They were in competition. And Mr. Vorpagel was running around town making false accusations about Mr. Kosciuszko robbing people of tens of thousands of dollars and telling people he was going to harm him. Luke Kosciuszko had the greatest motivation for doing some harm. Mr. Visada did not.
She reminded the jury of the relationships between everyone woven into the case. How Luke was rivals with Sean and Charles. Why else was Sean armed with a gun, though he had never gotten a chance to fire it? Was Sean anticipating Luke to attack after Sean's private conversation with Chris the night before the shootings? And the defense reminded the jury how Chris was also friends with Sean and Charles, and how they were business partners. It didn't make sense for Chris to want to kill them, given their personal history together.
These things are important. That background is important because you're all human. You all have friends. You all have family. You all have acquaintances. There isn't anything magical about people that become involved in the drug trade. There's nothing the state has presented that suggests to you that Mr. Vasada is a violent individual who has done anything like this before. Their only evidence is that he was friends with these individuals.
The defense warned the jury not to turn to their emotions, which would naturally be strong in such a tragic case with three young lives lost. Instead, they needed to remember to objectively look at every piece of evidence in the case and presume innocence rather than assume guilt. When it came time for a verdict, the jury found Chris Vasada guilty on all five counts. Now was the next question. Would Chris Vasada live, or would he be sentenced to the death penalty? Law and Crime's Jesse Weber and trial attorney Brad Micklin debated his sentence.
It's a complicated case, but one of the things that's on the line here is the death penalty. Now, the death penalty here, this would be a rare thing if it were actually imposed in this case. Am I correct in thinking about that?
Yes, it's been a long time since they've executed somebody in Florida. I believe even the defendant's attorney at some point was trying to have it declared unconstitutional, but unsuccessfully.
Chris's attorneys assured the jury that they do accept their verdict, but asked them to open their hearts and learn more about the challenges Chris had dealt with since he was a child. None of what they would hear was an excuse for his actions or for sympathy, said Palm Beach County Public Defender Carrie Hawat. But they wanted the jury to gain a deeper glimpse into Chris and his life to better understand how he had ended up in the courtroom, convicted of murder. You will hear of a heart that has been scarred by loss and abandonment, Hawat said, standing at the podium during the penalty phase of the trial. As an adult, he also underwent a traumatic brain injury and then had substance abuse issues, which affected his judgment and behavior further. A medical doctor testified about Chris's brain that showed neurological damage. Chris's upbringing was chaotic and unstable with his two siblings. Chris's mother, who jumped from relationship to relationship and was struggling financially to raise her family as she tried to become a nurse, cut ties with Chris's father and grandmother. Eventually, she would cut ties with her own children. She had another child with a man named Juan, who treated Chris like a stepson. Chris's mother left Juan for a 19-year-old named Jennifer, a nursing student. Jennifer Eisen Kearns eventually earned the title of mom. She cared for Chris and his siblings, four children under the age of nine, and raised them in tents in a campground for 6 weeks because they wanted to save money to buy a house. The 19-year-old, now a mature woman, testified.
What was your relationship like with the kids?
Well, I think this is when Toy Story 1 was just out, and it was to Infinity and Beyond. And that was kind of my way in, and it's kind of ironic because Toy Story 4 is coming out right now. And I remember my way of, like, connecting with them was that I am going to love you until infinity and beyond, which still holds true today. And they really clinged on to me pretty quickly. You know, I became the primary parent pretty quickly. You know, she worked two jobs, and that was the focus. So, you know, I was doing the cooking, the cleaning, the bathing, the nurturing.
What did Christopher call you after you were living there and his father was gone?
It was Mama Jen for most of the time, and then it turned to Mom.
Chris's mother slowly stopped visiting them until she disappeared completely. Chris's siblings cried. Chris acted like the man of the tent, Jennifer said. Chris eventually went to live with Juan, who fell back on selling drugs. He sometimes drove with the children to make stops. The defense argued that Chris was emotionally scarred. He compulsively pulled out his hair as a child. He couldn't stop as an adult. He had bald spots. In adulthood, he became addicted to a product called Shatter, a form of cannabis extract that left him violently ill and sent him to the emergency room multiple times. Chris graduated from high school, had a girlfriend, and went to study at Palm Beach State College. By now, his foray into illegal activities was already underway. In high school, he had sold small amounts of marijuana, a drug dealing enterprise that was expanding. He chose drugs over his girlfriend. In 2012, he was involved in a car crash. He rode in the car with a drunk driver, the defense said, when the car rolled over and he was seriously injured. The drunk driver fled the scene and left Chris in the back seat. The drunk driver's identity was a familiar name brought up during the murder trial. It was Luke Katsoukos, the defense attorney said, noting the dark irony. Chris Fasada had grown tired of living in the shadows and wanted an honest life and to become a legitimate entrepreneur, his attorney said. Jennifer, reflecting on Chris's life up until this point, closed her eyes and took a deep breath, fighting back tears during her chance to leave departing words with the jury before they reached a decision on his sentencing.
I just want to be clear that I am not blinded to the reality of the situation. And I am pained for the families, and I send my deepest compassion. And it's a very tragic situation. But I want you to know that Chris's life was a tragedy as well.
But during the course of the two-day penalty phase, the jury heard from the other side as well. Loved ones from the three victims who stood in front of the court and opened up about the loss they experienced and what they said Chris had stolen from them. Sean's father was one of them who spoke.
Sean's death has forever changed the lives of our family. My wife and daughter will never be the same, and neither will I. We will never hear his voice again. We will never hear his laugh. We will never feel his big hugs again.
Chris's defense team sat with their heads bowed into their hands while they waited for the jury to announce whether or not he would be sentenced to the death penalty. A death penalty sentence meant the jurors reached a unanimous decision. Chris was stoic, emotionless, the same way he had looked for most of his trial. The sentence was out.
We, the jury, unanimously find that Christopher Fasada should be sentenced to death. No.
No to the death penalty on all charges. The judge sentenced Chris Fasada to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
So it's pretty straightforward. On the three counts of first-degree murder, I sentence the defendant to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. There is the count of grand theft auto, which is a third-degree felon. I hereby sentence him to 5 years in the Department of Corrections on that count. And the attempted first-degree murder of Charles Vorpagel, I sentence him to life imprisonment as well. Sometimes at this juncture, the judge says all sorts of things, and I'm going to say very little. I have a lot of personal feelings about what's happened here, and I'm not so sure there's anything I can say that would make the victim's family feel any better. Additionally, I don't think there's anything I can say to the defendant who's being sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole that it's anything he wants to hear as well. And then lastly, I have a co-defendant case that I don't want any of my comments to be construed that I wouldn't be fair. So I'm going to stay quiet. It doesn't mean I don't have a lot of personal feelings about what took place in this courtroom since May 31st.
The judge referenced Marcus Stewart, who prosecutors believe to be the second shooter. Marcus was charged with three counts of first-degree murder, But more than a year after Chris's sentencing, Marcus has yet to stand trial. Palm Beach County State Attorney's Office confirmed to Court Junkie that jury trials aren't happening now because of the coronavirus. The Palm Beach Post newspaper reported that police closed the investigation in 2019. Luke Katsoukos, once a person of interest, has never been charged in connection to the shootings, according to court records. And that's all for today's episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think. Do you believe the jury got it right? Do you think the investigation should have been closed? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram, at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Gabrielle Roussan. To hear these episodes ad-free, or to hear additional Court Junkie bonus episodes, go to courtjunkie.com/support, which will redirect you to my Patreon page. And Court Junkie now also has a YouTube channel, and I plan on posting all sorts of stuff on there, including a Zoom call with my social media manager, Cece. You can check that out by going to youtube.com/courtjunkie and subscribing. Thanks again for listening. Until next time. If you're a business owner, you don't need me to tell you that running a business is tough, but you might be making it harder on yourself than necessary. Don't let QuickBooks and spreadsheets slow you down anymore. It's time to upgrade to NetSuite. Stop paying for multiple systems that don't give you the information you need when you need it. Ditch the spreadsheets and all the old software you've outgrown. Now is the time to upgrade to NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. NetSuite gives you visibility and control over your financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more. Everything you need, all in one place, instantaneously. Whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in revenue, save time and money with NetSuite. Join over 21,000 companies using NetSuite right now. Let NetSuite show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/court. Schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/court. That's netsuite.com/court.
When I was 10 years old, I told my mom, "Mom, when I grow old, I'm gonna be a drug dealer." And she's shook.
Oh, spit, wow.
You know, slapped me across the face and said, "If you want to kill me, that's what you do." And when I was 13 years old, I told my mom, "Mom, you think you'd be the best drug trainer in the world?" She turned around. She said, "You can be whatever you want." So I spent Christmas and New Year's at the border trying to jump it.
You get this reputation as the guy who can walk 30 dogs.
That's when I can't. It was in San Diego.
You were kind of this underground guy for a while that could walk all these dogs.
Yeah. In L.A.
Yeah. With no leash. And the gangbangers are hanging out. Yeah. And like, there goes the crazy guy with all the dogs. Yeah. Don't mess with the guy with the dogs.
Right. My customers were NBA players, you know, NFL players.
So you're worried.
Nicolas Cage. Yeah.
Nicolas Cage?
Nicolas Cage. Okay. Ben Diesel.
How did they hear about you?
Yeah. You know? The Mexican guy in the street.
You're washing limos and you're like, "Yeah, I want to be on TV."
Yeah.
People must have been like, "Okay, buddy."
Most of them. I was first interviewed by the LA Times. At the end of the conversation, the lady says, "So what would you like to do next?" I said, "Well, we'd like to have a TV show." So I manifested the TV show way before producers came, and I had no idea. I didn't know that dishonesty part in Hollywood. You better have a good pack of lawyers.
For more from Cesar Millan, including how animal behavior is reflective of their human owners, check out episode 162 of The Jordan Harbinger Show.